Good afternoon and welcome to the November program of Senior Statesmen of Virginia. I'm Jeff Gould, President, and today we have a very timely topic, particularly given the summit that's currently going on in Europe. And today's title of the program is Virginia and Climate Control. It's my pleasure to introduce our moderator for today, Bob McGrath, who's a former former president of Senior Statesmen. Bob, it's all yours.
Thanks, Jeff. Exactly a year ago, Senior Statesmen had a program with the director of Virginia's Department of Mines, Minerals, and Energy to explain to us the details of the then brand new Virginia Clean Economy Act. The act required electric utility companies to get to net zero carbon emissions by 2050. And also commits Virginia to join a group of 9 Northeastern and Mid-Atlantic states in something called the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative. It's a cap and trade entity designed to lower carbon emissions. Today, we're fortunate, as Jeff said, to have Professor William Shoby, who will tell us how implementation of the VCEA is going. But more generally, he'll explain to us his ideas for how Virginia might take on the much more ambitious goal of getting to net zero carbon, not just for the electric sector, but across the board. Professor Shoby is an economist and a professor of public policy at the University of Virginia, and he directs the Center for Economic and Policy Studies there. His current research includes emission market and auction design, carbon removal technologies, electricity demand forecasting, and deep decarbonization strategies for Virginia. He was part of the team that designed the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative and has done considerable work on evaluating its effectiveness and on other cap and trade systems, such as the ones in the European Union and in California. Before coming to the University of Virginia, Bill was Associate Director of Virginia's Department of Planning and Budget. Now, we'll have plenty of time for questions at the end of the presentation, and please use the Q&A function to send them in, and we'll be sure to ask them. So, Bill, the floor, so to speak, is yours. Please tell us about all these things. Thanks for being here.
All right. Thanks a lot, Bob. I appreciate it. So just a quick introduction to the group I have here at the Weldon Cooper Center for Public Service. We have taken an interest in the energy transition here and are building what we hope can be a center of excellence for helping Virginia chart an effective pathway for reducing its climate changing emissions over the course of the next 30 or so years. So we've already done some initial planning work. Our group is working with the Department of Mines, Minerals, and Energy, now the Department of Energy, they've changed their name recently, on a report to the General Assembly on how to cost effectively achieve our mid-century emission reduction goals. And we're very keen to think about the opportunities and roadblocks. What actions do we need to take to help facilitate the cost-effective transition to non-emitting technologies? And I'll spend a good bit of time talking about what we think is important in this regard. Just a little shout out to people we work with and our sponsors. We've received generous support from S-Power, which is now just a division of the AES Corporation, the Clean Air Task Force, and our modeling partners, Evolved Energy Research and Department of Mines, Minerals, and Energy. So thanks very much for that. Here's the basic picture for Virginia. Here are our CO2 emissions. I'm going to leave methane out of the discussion. It's been a huge topic in Glasgow, as for those of you following the news, a very important initiative. But we're going to concentrate on CO2 emissions because this is Virginia's primary contribution to greenhouse gases. There's not a lot of methane extraction in the Commonwealth, although there is methane use, not an incredible amount of methane releases from Virginia. So I'll concentrate on CO2 emissions. But you see the pattern. The pattern is that around 2006, 2007, Virginia had its peak CO2 emissions. They dropped off rapidly through this period and then have sort of leveled off statewide. And that's true even though in the electricity sector alone, which is this blue line at the bottom, emissions have continued to track down gradually. And I'll talk about a little bit about what's giving rise to this pattern. So let me just run you through some data really quickly, because we got to start with some data in order to understand the picture what we're trying to accomplish. So here we have monthly generation by fuel in Virginia. The blue line at the top is the total. That's our total generation each month from the year 2000 to the present. And you notice a couple of things that are important to notice here. There's been a huge shift between coal here and natural gas here. Coal has dropped off. Natural gas has increased rapidly. Bob, I'd like to suggest you mute your microphone there. Nuclear has been very steady all across. That's the green line. And then down here at the very bottom, you'll see our renewables technologies. We have I have graphed hydro, wind, and solar in pink, and then biomass is down there. You can hardly see it right there at the bottom. Okay, so this is the mix of generation we have. And the big story here over the last few decades has been the transition from coal to natural gas as our primary electricity resource. And that's caused a substantial reduction in emissions from the electricity sector over that time. Here's generation, the total picture of generation. I just want to point out that there's been a big shift in the import picture. This is a picture of imports of electricity into Virginia. And I want to point this out because there's been, when you think about our generation, when you think about our emissions, you have to think about, well, what are our emissions within the state? But what emissions are we generating with all of our electricity? And what you'll notice here is that after about 2010, our imports of electricity dropped a lot. And that was because we had a very aggressive strategy for building new natural gas-fired power plants in the state. And it was a policy that was intended to reduce our electricity emissions and our electricity imports, and for us to generate more of our own electricity. This happened over several years after 2010, and that process is more or less completed now. We added a lot of natural gas capacity over here. Our imports flattened out, and you'll see that play out in some of the pictures. Now I want to give you a close-up of the later years in that earlier picture. The blue line here is coal generation. The blue line is coal generation, and this is just 2016 to 2020, so you see coal continued to drop. And what you see right down at the bottom is that our renewables were asleep down here at the bottom, but right at the end of our horizon, we have this red line picking up really fast, and that's the increase in solar generation in Virginia. And I want to give you another picture of that really close up. This is all of our renewables in Virginia. And you'll notice a very sort of steady supply of wood and hydropower over this period. Solar, non-existent until 2016, and then it really took off. And one of the things that I'd like to point out about this is this solar was planned before the Clean Economy Act was passed. So this is the increase in solar generation in Virginia before we started trying very hard. And the reason this is happening is because solar is now the cheapest energy resource, new energy source for Virginia. If we're going to build new generation capacity, then the cheapest place to go is solar. It's cheaper than building new natural gas. It's cheaper than building new coal. It's cheaper than any other resource we have available. Now, I want to expand our view a little bit. I want to move out just from Virginia to our entire independent system operator, and it's called PJM. That stands for Pennsylvania, Jersey, and Maryland, by the way, because those three states got together and formed this organization for managing the grid. And then Virginia joined, West Virginia, Ohio, and little pieces of other states also became part of PJM. When we generate electricity, it goes into this big pool of electrons that serve all this region. This region is very closely connected by transmission lines. And so when you dump electricity in one place, it goes into this big pool and gets served out to all the uses in PJM. So I want to give you a little data about our entire region. So you see a slightly different view, but the same sort of idea about PJM that I was telling about Virginia. So this is a picture of solar generation in PJM. This is daily solar generation since 2016. And you'll notice back in 2016, there was practically none. And it's really started to take off in the last couple of years. And again, this solar development takes a few years. If you want to build a utility scale solar plant, you have to start planning it 4, even 5 years in advance. And so all of this solar you're seeing developed that's come online this year was planned before the Clean Economy Act was passed in 2020. But you'll notice solar is now routinely over 1% of the generation in PJM, whereas just a couple of years ago, it was never achieving even 0.5%. It's really started to take off very fast because the cost has fallen so far that now it makes more sense to build a solar plant than any other kind of new electricity source. And this is a picture of renewables generally. This includes wind, which is mostly coming from out in Illinois and Ohio, in Indiana. But so renewables generation is rising, but there's a cautionary tale here, and that's embedded in this picture. This is a picture of all non-emitting generation in PJM. So what we're after is an electricity sector that doesn't emit CO2 as a byproduct of generation. And what you'll notice here is that even though renewables are rising fairly quickly in PJM, this data shows a fairly flat profile of non-emitting emissions. And the reason is we're retiring nuclear plants. And when you retire one nuclear plant, you have to build a lot of wind turbines and solar panels to make up for that one nuclear plant. A nuclear reactor runs at 90% capacity. A utility-scale solar plant in Virginia runs at about 22 or 23% capacity. That meaning of all the hours out of the year, it generates its average amount of power that amount of time. So the capacity factor of a nuclear plant is much, much higher than the capacity factor of a solar plant, just because solar plants generate on a daily cycle. What this illustrates is the importance of our existing nuclear fleet as a bridge generation technology for reaching any sort of decarbonization that we want to achieve. All right, so now I've just run through some data really quickly for you because I wanted you to see a few things. First of all, we've substituted a lot of natural gas for coal, but now all of a sudden, solar in particular in Virginia, but wind power, if you think about all of PJM, have become the cheapest new electricity resources, and they're being built very quickly now. And the build of these new resources started before we passed a law requiring that they be built. We're building them because they're cheap in terms of the new electricity supply we want to bring online. So what I want to talk about now is we've talked about how emissions from the electricity sector fell, and interestingly, you remember we saw the emissions from the electricity sector fall, even though our imports were falling at the same time. And that's because even though we were importing less and generating more ourselves, we were generating it with natural gas instead of with coal. So we had this natural gas emits about half as much as coal for a megawatt hour of electricity production. So even though we were generating more of our electricity, our emissions went down because the emission intensity of our electricity sector went down. And now that we've primarily made the transition away from coal toward natural gas, any future emission reductions are going to need to come from new technology, renewables, and other non-emitting technologies. I will say just an interesting fact you may not be aware of. We for the first 8 months of 2021, we generated almost exactly the same amount of electricity using solar energy that we did using coal. And this is an enormous shift in Virginia from 20 years ago when coal was our primary energy electricity source. Okay, I want to talk, I'm going to talk just a second about the Clean Economy Act because it's not the focus of my talk today. The focus of my talk today is about getting the whole economy to zero or close to zero. And I want to talk about strategies we have to think about if we want to get the whole economy to zero. But I will talk about the Clean Economy Act just for a little bit because it's our first shot. It's the first major policy initiative to get emissions down. And it definitely moved Virginia into very much a leadership role. The number of states that actually have a mid-century economy, electricity sector 100% decarbonization goal is under 12. You know, it depends on how you count what different policy states have, but we're in a small group of states that have made very strong commitments to reduce emissions from our electricity sector. And the problem we face is that our electricity sector is only about 30% of our emissions. We've already reduced emissions from the electricity sector a fair amount. What's left is coming from transportation, from buildings, and from industry. And now we have to think about, all right, we think we might have a pathway to zero for the electricity sector. Now we have to think about how we get the rest of the economy to zero as well. So just to remind you about the Clean Economy Act, before we move on, it has essentially, four major components: a renewable portfolio standard, which means all of our, any part of our generation that emits fossil fuels has to be progressively covered more and more with renewables. And we're leaving the current nuclear fleet in place, and then what's left, we cover with greater shares of renewables. We joined the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, but Virginia did something that no other state has done yet. The law specifies that our budget under the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative cap, our budget will go to zero by 2049. And so that's a hard backup cap that takes our electricity sector emissions to zero. There are specific resources that are required to be built. I'll talk about this a little bit more in a minute, but essentially there's a bunch of offshore wind, there's a bunch of solar that's required, and then some batteries. So the law has a specific schedule of builds that need to be made of these technologies. And again, I'll talk about those in just a bit, because some of those actually act to raise the cost of getting to our goal. And so the question is, do they provide some compensating benefit? The Virginia Clean Economy Act also requires all coal to shut down by 2024, except for the Virginia City Hybrid Energy Center down in Wise, which was started in 2012. So it's a really brand new, one of the newest coal plants in the country. And then all fossil generation by 2045. So that's a key stopping point for fossil generation by our utilities in the state. And the law also specifies some energy conservation activity, but that is not very aggressive by today's standards. Last year, we added the clean car standard, and that's going to turn out to be important in just a minute. All right, so let's just look at a picture of what I just talked about. The electric power sector is over here on the left. This is what's left. So this is 2017. You'll notice there's a substantial amount of coal still used in 2017. If this were a picture of 2020 or 2021, this sliver would be much smaller. It would be much more natural gas, and even a little bit of solar would start to show up. But the emissions from coal have gone down and from natural gas have gone up. But the lion's share of our emissions in the state are from the transportation sector. There are emissions from cars and trucks, and to a lesser extent, aviation fuels. And without tackling this portion of our emissions, we can't get the economy anywhere close to net zero by mid-century. Then we have the industrial emissions. These are much harder to reduce because for many industrial processes, we don't yet have a replacement technology for high temperature heat that fossil fuels provide us. Finally, there's the building sector, and this is primarily heating, cooling, and lighting for our building sector. And we have the emissions from the building sector are primarily from natural gas, although there are some petroleum products, oil, used for home heating and for commercial purposes. All right, so this is the current picture. The electricity sector, at least we have a law that takes care of that part. But now we have to make sure we include these other sectors if we're going to bring our emissions down to some level compatible with, say, our obligations under the Paris Climate Accords. All right. So just to give you, we did a fairly substantial modeling exercise earlier this year. And what we wanted to do is ask, can we chart a technology path to take the entire economy to zero by 2050 and it not eat up a bigger chunk of the economy than energy takes now? So this was the goal we set for ourselves. Can we find a path to zero that won't cost us a bigger share of the economy for energy than we now spend? And the answer is that as long as technology keeps developing along at its current pace, nice if it goes faster, but even if it keeps developing at its current pace, we feel like there is an affordable strategy to get to net zero emissions by 2050. And I'm going to describe it in some detail over the next few minutes. It generates net benefits for the state in money saved, a lot of health benefits, and then, of course, those essential climate benefits. We will not be contributing to increasing CO2 concentrations in the atmosphere. We ran several scenarios because what we wanted to understand is how sensitive is that result to some of the assumptions we've made. And it's very clear that different policy approaches and different priorities lead to a different resource mix. And I'll show you that in just a minute. It's really important, though, that we begin planning this process now, because some of the decisions we make today will still be relevant in 2050 when we're supposed to hit our decarbonization goal. Some of the things we're doing today, like building a new natural gas power plant, for example, a natural gas power plant you build today will be in service in 2050, unless you decide to throw it away early. And so decisions we make on large capital investments today will have an effect on how much it costs to reach our goal in 2050. It's really important to coordinate between state and local governments, because a lot of renewables are distributed in their production. So they take place across localities in the Commonwealth, and coordination between, because localities have the zoning power and guard that power very jealously, it's important that states and that the state and localities coordinate if we're going to be able to achieve our decarbonization goals. And also getting started now in at least thinking and planning for this process makes the whole thing easier to accomplish. Again, if we keep building fossil infrastructure for the next 10 years, we'll find either we can't get to 2050, zero in 2050, or we have to throw away capital that hasn't been fully depreciated yet, that hasn't outlived its usefulness. All right. And this is just a picture of that. This just shows the speed of replacement of different investments we make. Light bulbs, every 5 years, light bulbs get replaced. So no problem. Even if we waited till for 15 years to start replacing light bulbs, we could get most of them replaced in time. Appliances, you all probably have some older appliances in your own homes. I know I certainly do. I don't replace them very quickly. Vehicles take even longer to turn over. So if we're going to electrify our vehicle fleet, that needs to start fairly soon. Vehicles that we put in service in 10 years from now, some of them will still be in service in 2050. Not many, but some. Now, as we get down to the bottom of this graph, these are things that we actually have to start changing our investments in them right away if these investments are going to pay off in 2050. Pipelines we build now will still be in service. Power plants will still be in service. Commercial boilers will still be in service. So we need to think about what are our priorities, which things do we have to address first so that we don't make investments now that will force us to throw productive assets away in order to get to our goal in 2050. So let me just talk about what any pathway to decarbonization looks like. Any pathway to decarbonization has four components. We have many studies across the country on this. There have been national studies. There have been a variety of state studies. We worked with Evolved Energy Research, which is one of the many firms that does this kind of modeling, to do a model specific for Virginia on this. But you'll find other studies by other firms that reach generally the same conclusions. If you want to decarbonize, you need to one of the important things you need to do is address end-use efficiency and the responsiveness of end-use to the availability of resources. So you need to be able to move demand around so it matches renewable supply, and you need to make most efficient use of energy. That's pillar number one. Pillar number two, you decarbonize the electricity sector. We've got that one checked. Right? We've checked that one off. Virginia has a policy for decarbonizing its electricity sector. So we'll put a check by number two. Number three is electrify everything. Remember our picture of transportation and our picture of buildings? These are two sectors that currently directly use fossil fuels for energy services. So we use natural gas for heating and cooling of buildings. We use gasoline for transportation. And we have the opportunity to provide the transportation services and the building energy services with electricity. And doing so would automatically save us quite a lot of energy, but it would also allow us to provide the energy used for that service from our decarbonized electricity sector. If we're going to decarbonize our electricity sector, then we want to make a priority replacing the direct use of fossil fuels with electricity. And then finally, virtually any path to net zero requires some negative emissions, some capture of CO2. It might be through natural processes biological processes, or it might be technology. You all have probably read recently about efforts underway to build technologies that remove carbon from the atmosphere and then sequester it in geological formations. There was just a story about Iceland last week or week before, for example. These stories are all coming out right now because we're in the middle of our climate negotiations and everybody's writing lots of stories about these things. But it turns out that one of the things we can do in Virginia, we burn a lot of wood right now for electricity generation. If we were to take the amount of wood and wood waste that we burn right now and change the process that we use so that we capture the carbon from that process and that we can generate some either electricity or hydrogen during this combustion process, but we capture the carbon, we can actually have a negative carbon process that generates some usable fuel for us. And these technologies are under development right now. They're not cost effective for us yet, but our feeling is that by 2050, we should have within our reach the ability to capture and sequester carbon from some of the biofuels we use. And so capturing carbon will be one of our options. Okay. So we did a bunch of scenarios. I'm not going to go through our scenarios in detail, but we just made some basic assumptions about the availability of resources. Now, there's one I want to point out in particular here. I just list them here, but they're all just sort of their assumptions about that we any model would have used here. But one I want to point out in particular is when we did our modeling, we limited the land used for utility scale solar generation to no more than 1% of the land area of the state. Under some modeling assumptions, you will get models spitting out results that would require us to use 5% of our land area for utility scale solar generation. And in my mind, such a dramatic change in land use over the course of just 30 years is not a realistic assumption to be making. So in all of our assumptions, we actually strictly limited the amount of solar we used for generation, even though it's our cheapest resource. Our thought is once we get past 1% of the land area, probably the cost of using more land for solar will go up. And so it's not realistic to think about solar continuing to be the cheapest resource, even as it uses a larger and larger share of land. So we strictly limited this to, and 1% of land is not actually that much. We have more than that in roads and urban development. So we've shifted land use by more than 1% within our lifetimes. And so that's not a terrible, we felt not an unrealistic assumption. So we also assumed, we made assumptions about population growth and about available technologies for for energy efficiency. And I won't go into those in detail. Those are all sort of details about our modeling. But we tried some scenarios. We said, let's use the sort of standard scenario for technology costs, the one that's published by the National Renewable Energy Labs every year. Let's just take their standard forecast and use that one. Fortunately for us, their forecast tends to be a little conservative. Costs have fallen faster than those estimates in the past several years, and we can hope that that keeps happening. But we didn't want a scenario that started with a set of rose-colored glasses. We wanted to take the central technology scenario and say, can we do it if we don't get lucky? And then we tried some other scenarios that sort of stress test our model. And again, I won't bother going into some of the details, but here are the basic results. We'll use a lot of solar and offshore wind. We need our existing nuclear as a foundation for this if we're going to get to zero by the mid-century. We'll, of course, need to build some sort of storage technology, but we don't really know what that will be yet. There are so many people working on new storage technologies that, you know, our hope is that there will be some interesting long-term storage technologies. For example, we might generate hydrogen and store it in caverns. We might produce ammonia and store it in bulk. Ammonia can be used as a fuel, and you can produce it using your solar energy or your wind power, and then it can be stored and used as a fuel. There are some efforts to use ammonia as a fuel in shipping right now. So one sort of interesting result from our modeling is that we keep our current natural gas capacity around, but over time we burn less and less natural gas in it. Later in our modeling horizon, we use some synthetic fuel, either hydrogen or ammonia or some other synthetic fuel for use in our power plants, because we need some flexible energy resource that can be ramped up and down to match our renewables. And then again, we'll need some negative emissions. So here's essentially the bottom line. The top bar here shows how much electricity we'll need to generate in 2050 under our existing load and existing load growth. And that includes our data center growth and increasing use of electric vehicles and all that stuff. That's in the top bar. The bottom bar sort of adds up all the resources we found that we could use. Now, let me just run through what those are. We have our existing nuclear on the left. That's the dark green. Now, a sort of ambitious assumption that we make is there will be some new nuclear technology available by 2050. There are lots of firms working on small modular nuclear reactors and new safer designs for reactors that presumably won't take 30 years to build once we have the technology. So our models definitely would pick some new nuclear technology if they were available. There's a lot of solar, both rooftop utility scale is in the yellow and rooftop solar in orange. And then finally, offshore wind. We have a huge offshore wind resource. Virginia doesn't really have that great an onshore wind resource. So if we're going to be using wind, probably it's offshore. All right. So I want to speed through a couple of these slides. I think I have a little more detail than I need on some of these things. Let me just, I'm having a little trouble seeing this slide here. So there we go. All right. So the key point on this slide is that the gray in the middle, the big gray in the early part here is that's our natural gas. Our liquid fuels, that's what we're using in transportation. And if we're gonna win this and get to net zero by 2050, that's a nut we really have to crack. So we have to take all that gasoline and convert it to electricity instead of gasoline to fuel our vehicles. So that's one of the big things we have to do. And what that's going to mean is that demand for electricity is going to rise because we're substituting electricity for all those other fuels. We're substituting electricity for gas. We're substituting electricity for natural gas used in homes. And we're substituting electricity for some industrial processes as well. So our demand for electricity will rise. And the generation pathways we modeled accommodate the added electricity we need to generate if we're going to convert all those current uses of fossil fuels over to electricity. All right. This is just another view of the same thing. You see buildings go from using a fair amount of natural gas for building energy services. That's all replaced by electricity by the end of the horizon. In industry, we have a harder time with. You see, there's not that many changes in industry. But the transportation sector, we take to electricity by 2050. Interestingly, it doesn't require as much electricity as you might think to run our cars on electricity because they're so much more efficient run on electricity than on on fossil fuels. Electric cars are so much more efficient in terms of converting the energy in storage in the vehicle into motion for the vehicle. All right. This is a map of the technologies we see coming online. On top, no matter what scenario we use, we come out using a lot of solar energy because it's so cheap. And offshore wind is not cheap yet, but we expect it will be. Once we get lots of experience with it, already the costs in the European context have fallen quite a lot. And our expectation is that by near the end of our planning horizon, offshore wind will be a cost-effective resource. We're already building some as sort of a loss leader, but our expectation is we have a very good offshore wind resource and we'll use a lot more of it. And again, this is just a picture of the generation, just lots of solar and wind replacing natural gas. So that's the real lesson here for generation. I'm going to skip this one. This is, let me just talk about hydrogen for a second, because there's a lot of talk about hydrogen. And our feeling is that in 2050, mostly we'll be using hydrogen in heavy transport, that mostly hydrogen will be used for large trucks and trains and things like that, rather than being used in buildings or in passenger cars. So hydrogen essentially will be used in heavy transport. Now, look, this is way out in the future, so we're starting to get pretty speculative out there, but we're not expecting hydrogen to be much of a contribution in the early part of the horizon. Okay, I'm going to skip that and now just get to the end. Let me just finish up here, and then I'd love to have some questions and conversation. How much does it cost is a key question. And what this graph displays is the increases in costs for some things and decreases in costs for other things. So, for example, as we electrify the light-duty vehicle fleet, we're actually saving a lot of money, because electric vehicles, assuming that the technology progresses as fast as it seems to be, is going to be much cheaper for consumers than burning fossil fuels. It'll be much cheaper to run electric cars. They have less in the way of mechanical things to go wrong, so they're cheaper to run, and eventually will be cheaper, as cheap to buy. So there's lots of money to be saved in buildings and in transportation, but we'll be spending more on some of our generation technologies. We have to build new generation technologies and pay for them. And so these little diamonds show the net cost of moving to a decarbonized economy. But it's not nearly as large as one might think, because there's a lot to be saved in moving from a fossil fuel economy to an electricity-based energy economy. Let me just get down to start talking about policy a little bit. And I've already talked about some of these things, but we have 30 years, and so we can do a lot of things in 30 years. Would we naturally decarbonize the economy in 30 years, given the current technologies available? Probably not. Not unless we were imposing a substantial price on CO2 emissions or some other dramatic incentive to reduce our emissions. And so we have to think about how we want to drive the adoption of technologies. And in the Clean Economy Act, we already have some policy drivers. We have the Renewable Portfolio Standard, and we have my favorite, which is the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative. Incidentally, the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, with Virginia being members, now has 11 members, New Jersey had pulled out at one time and is back in, and Virginia is in, and Pennsylvania is actually well on the way to joining the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative right now, which is super interesting because they're a very large emitter of greenhouse gases because they produce so much energy there. And having Pennsylvania in the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative greatly increases the potential for reducing emissions over time. And it's really a positive development. To have Pennsylvania under a declining cap on its emissions is a really hopeful and optimistic sign. And North Carolina is also considering joining the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative. If Pennsylvania and North Carolina both joined, it would double the CO2 footprint that we had placed under a cap. And if you talk to the members of the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, their intent is to have the cap go to something like zero by mid-century. And so that's a really important policy initiative. It imposes a price on emissions and announces to investors and participants in the energy market that in the long run, we're headed to zero. And so it's a great policy to be using for getting to zero. I'm just looking at these points. They're all pretty obvious. Innovation is great. We'd love more of that, but states can't really drive innovation the way national governments and international efforts can. But again, I want to come back to this point of coordinating between state and local governments, because that's going to be super important in using renewables. There's going to have to be improved coordination on the siting of especially utility scale solar facilities. Again, almost any model that you do of the electricity sector decarbonizing will have you keep your natural gas around, but run it less and less, unless you can start putting zero carbon fuels in. If you can come up with cost-effective zero carbon fuels, you might actually use your natural gas plants much longer and more. But if that turns out to be expensive, the natural gas plants hang around, but they're used less and less and less. They're mostly balancing resources for moving up and down as renewables become available or not. We'll use a lot more storage to take that role on as we get into the out years. All right. I want to bring up 3 points, things that worry me, things that might get in the way, and things that we're working on in particular, because we think they're super important in helping us get to where we need to go. One really important problem that hasn't yet been addressed is, what are we going to do about our transmission network, our transmission and distribution network? The transmission system we have right now was built for taking bulk power from a big power plant to a load center somewhere. And that's just not the way electricity is going to be used and provided in the future. We have houses generating electricity. We have solar farms generating electricity. We have wind turbines scattered around the countryside and off the coast generating electricity. If we're going to do that, we're going to need to make some substantial upgrades to our transmission and distribution infrastructure. And it turns out that transmission is not something that one state should do by itself. Transmission upgrades are much more cost effective when they're done in a coordinated regional way. And so one of the things that we're missing right now is a clearly coordinated effort. And in fact, it's really important for the states along the eastern seaboard, New Jersey down to North Carolina. It's really important for us to cooperate now, because we're going to build all these offshore wind resources, and bringing that huge wind resource onto land and then transmitting it out to where it can be used can be very expensive unless we plan ahead and are careful about developing a transmission system that's as cost-effective as possible. And that requires regional planning, not state-by-state planning. So here's a place where we need to be getting together with our neighboring states and working on a joint plan for cost-effectively harvesting our wind resource so that our transmission system can serve the load and won't cost more than it needs to. I've already mentioned solar siting as a potential friction point. You all have probably heard in the news about some localities that have been less than receptive to the siting of solar facilities. So we need to think about the design of solar facilities so that they are considered more attractive by localities. And we need to think about making sure localities receive the full benefits of having these facilities. Some years ago, the Virginia General Assembly gave solar facilities a huge discount on their local taxes. And when they did this, this was intended to be a boost to new solar facilities, but it had the unintended consequence of greatly diminishing local governments' enthusiasm for new solar facilities, because they couldn't tax a solar facility at the same rate they would tax a new warehouse or some other facility in the same tax class. So localities had to give a big discount to this new solar farm that they didn't have to give to other facilities. So it ended up reducing the receptiveness that localities had toward new solar facilities. It had an unintended consequence. It was intended to be a boost to new solar development. And our own feeling is that probably in the end, it's on net been more of a friction than a benefit to new solar siting in Virginia. Now, and the last point is something that I think this group will appreciate maybe more than almost any other points I've made. Virginia, like many states, hasn't really invested in a lot of its own administrative capacity for planning and modeling and coordinating a plan to get to zero emissions by 2050. The way it works in Virginia is our investor-owned utilities will come up with a plan for their next few years of managing their electricity generation and transmission. They'll propose to the State Corporation Commission. The State Corporation Commission develops their own opinion about it, and these two argue back and forth about it for a while, and they come to some agreement, and then we get a plan for the next few years. But there is no place in state government where we undertake long-range planning. We undertake coordinated work with other states to engage in transmission planning. Virginia, like other states, is going to need to develop a greater administrative capacity for planning the transition to a decarbonized economy. It's going to require 8 or 9 state agencies to be involved. And who's going to corral these agencies? Who's going to organize their efforts? Who's going to coordinate their efforts? So far, we haven't really attacked that problem. And my own feeling is that this is a huge friction point in the decarbonization effort for the state. We need to develop administrative capacity so we have an agency with both the expertise and the portfolio and the backing of the governor's office to have everyone pulling in the same direction, shall we say. And this is, in my own view, this is one of our key friction points that we have to address in the next few years if we're going to be serious about decarbonizing the economy. All right, so what do we need to do? Well, right now, we just need to stop building fossil infrastructure, and we need to start adding renewables and all that. And we need to start thinking about electrification of various aspects of demand. We're starting to electrify the transportation sector slowly. That's going to have to ramp up. But these are things that need to start now, right? Because we need to start thinking now about the things that have a really long lifespan. and will still be around in a long, you know, in 30 years. And then in the next decade, we continue to work on electrifying things that make direct use of fossil fuels. And then we expand storage, we expand our offshore wind, and begin to think about developing those new exotic technologies like carbon capture and storage or new nuclear, things that we don't know yet. We don't know yet which new technologies are going to win that lottery. And so now we start planning for this change and we start initiating some change in the 2030s. We're going to know more which technologies are going to be the cheap ones, which are going to be the reliable ones, and we'll know more about where we should start placing our investments so that in the 2040s, we're actually approaching decarbonization. All right, so we have the structured plan to approach the process of decarbonization. I've already said all these things. I'm going to skip over the slide just so we can have a little more time to talk about these issues. So here's my final slide. Thank you very much. I hope this has sparked some ideas and some questions, and I'm happy to hang around and join in the conversation.
Okay, Bill, thank you very much. The challenges of doing something about greenhouse gases seem so formidable to so many people. I think people often get discouraged. And it's marvelous to see the way you've laid out an ambitious but a well thought through plan for how we could actually get to net zero by 2050. So thank you very much. I know there are quite a few questions coming in. I'm going to take my moderator's authority for a minute, and I want to ask you a question to start off. I think at some point in the presentation, you said you could actually do all this with the constraint that total energy costs would not go up.
That's not exactly what I said. Well, I said as a share, energy costs as a share of economic activity. So the percent of amount of money we spend on energy as a share of the whole economy. That's right. That would not go up.
Great. Thanks. I understand. But now in your calculations, are you including the fact that you need to change out a lot of capital stock before it would normally reach its end of life?
Well, so yeah, that's a great question. And the answer is, mostly. A really good plan is going to preserve as much of our current capital stock as we can and retire as little of it really early as we can. So, for example, even in the Clean Economy Act, we're retiring all of our old coal that's not economic anymore by 2024. But the decision was made to leave the Virginia City Hybrid Energy Center in place. It was just built in 2012. We still owe money on it. If we're going to shut that plant down, we have to float a bond to pay Dominion because they built that plant on the guarantee, you know, on our guarantee. So my own feeling is we are actually going to want to do that. We're going to want to shut that plant early because it's costing us a lot of money to keep it there. So, but the answer is yes. What we try to do is build our resources on the most economical path that gets us to zero. And that means retiring stuff early as little as possible. So, but it does take into account the fact that we will be retiring some of our assets before their useful life is finished.
And what about, for example, expanding the electric grid? If you're going to electrify everything, as you indicated, you've got to spend an awful lot on grid modification.
Okay, I have 2 points to make about that. We have to spend money upgrading the grid no matter what we do. Our grid was designed for a different world. And even if we were not going to try to reach zero emissions by 2050, we are going to have to invest billions, some billions of dollars. That's not actually that much for grid services over the course of, you know, several years. We're going to have to be ready to invest some billions of dollars in improved transportation and distribution technology so that we can make cost-effective use of new energy resources. So it's a little hard to tell, well, what's the additional expenses you'll need to make on transmission and distribution that you wouldn't have to make if you weren't decarbonizing? I don't know the answer to that. I don't want to claim to know the answer to that. There will be additional costs if we're going to try to decarbonize. But what the point I want to emphasize is we have to be modernizing our grid, whether we shoot for a quick decarbonization or not.
Yeah. All right. Thanks. We have a question from Catherine Welch. She says, is it too late for new nuclear? Now, you've talked about preserving our nuclear plants. I guess the question is, do you advocate building more nuclear?
Well, so advocate is the wrong word. All I'm trying to do is choose technologies according to what we think the least cost mix of technologies is to meet our energy demand as we expect it to roll out. So my own view is that any cost-effective plan first means keeping our existing fleet in operation. We have actually a very cost-effective nuclear fleet in Virginia, and it's operated very well. Now, how about new nuclear? I don't think anyone is going to build another standard Westinghouse light water reactor. You see the experience that Georgia is having right now with a new nuclear plant that is having extreme cost overruns. And we're just not going to build those kind of nuclear plants. The question is, how long is it going to be before NuScale or some of these other companies that are working on small modular reactors, how long is it going to be before they are actually able to deploy those reactors cost effectively? We just don't know that yet. My own feeling is that there's enough time for one or more of these technologies to win that race and become part of the new energy mix. It's going to be a question we have to ask ourselves. Does this new nuclear technology satisfy us in terms of safety and reliability? Those are things we just don't know yet, and we'll have to decide as we go along. Our model shows that it will be easier to decarbonize if we can have some of that high capacity baseload power in place that nuclear can offer us. We don't have any other anticipated technologies that can do quite what nuclear can do for us at this time. Maybe we'll get those fusion reactors finally. I remember when I was 10 reading how fusion reactors were just around the corner, and you know, that's the story. But I think some of the new light water technologies may come along and be satisfactory for us. But that's something we have to wait until we see how that technology lottery comes out.
Okay, thanks. Yeah, the joke about fusion power is, as you probably know, that the break-even point will always be 20 years from today.
That's right. That's right.
Okay, Joan Chapman asks, here's an easy one for you. Wondering how the new Republican governor and House of Delegates may disrupt the path we are on toward decarbonizing. Will 4 years of lackluster direction toward renewables keep us from hitting our goals?
Well, so, yeah, I want a couple of thoughts about this. I'm no expert on politics. I'm wrong all the time about politics. So nothing I say about politics should be taken at face value. First of all, notice that a lot of that solar we're building was built before it was required. The planning started when we had a Republican General Assembly. And so a lot of solar will be built whether we have mandates or not, because it's the cheapest path forward. And I think that's very clear from Dominion's integrated resource plan. Now, there are a couple of institutional points that are important. The governor can't just replace the entire Air Board, for example, and the Department of Environmental Quality's, you know, a board for regulating air emissions. That takes time to reappoint boards. So, you know, some of the stuff is already in place. I doubt that a Republican governor and General Assembly is going to want to tell Hampton Roads, no, we don't want to build a new wind industry there after all. My guess is that the new administration will probably support the first wind power build offshore. My own feeling is that should have been delayed a little while to let the costs fall a little farther. But that wasn't my call. Folks in the General Assembly thought we ought to go ahead and be first movers so we can get some of that economic development advantage for Hampton Roads. And so I think some of that will happen anyway. So I'm not sure what the appetite is for the General Assembly for going back on either the Virginia Clean Economy Act or on the new clean car standard adopted last year. I have a feeling that there may not be that much interest in doing that. One thing does worry me. Our membership in REGI is not directed by law. It's permissive in law. So the governor could, over time, decide to pull Virginia out of the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, which I would find incredibly frustrating because cap and trade programs were first implemented by a Republican president. George H.W. Bush put the first cap and trade program in place to reduce acid rain back in the 90s. And it was at the time a Republican initiative for cost-effective regulation. And since then has been the sort of tide has turned against this market-based instrument for controlling emissions with Republicans. And I think that may be something that we discover, that it's better to let to try to use markets to accomplish what you want to accomplish. And I'm a big believer in it. I've studied these cap-and-trade programs and markets for years, and I think that they work really well for keeping costs down. And so one of the things I want to say in response to this question is probably the most important thing the new administration could do would be to concentrate on the most cost-effective path. There are lots of things we can do to save money to get there cheaper. The Clean Economy Act wasn't emphasizing the efficiency of getting there. It was emphasizing getting there. Now we need to go back and refine our approach and find the most cost-effective pathway so that people aren't paying a lot more for electricity to clean up the electricity supply. We can get there at a reasonable price. So let's concentrate on keeping the price as low as possible so that people from all political stripes could support clean energy.
Okay, great. Thank you. Daniel Alexander asks, in the relative short term, what would coordination with state government by localities look like?
Yeah, so the first thing I would like if I were king of the world would be to remove restrictions on how localities could apply their local business taxes to solar facilities. It's interesting. We're in a regulated utility state. The cost of solar is just passed through. So if there were taxes paid by localities, that doesn't change how much the solar developer is going to make, because if they were all paying these higher local taxes, the same local taxes that localities apply to other similar facilities, then that would be passed through, and they would all be bidding slightly higher prices when they would sell their power to Dominion. So one thing we should do is make sure it's worth localities' while. Solar facilities are actually very profitable for localities because there's not that much continuing employment at solar facilities, but you have a facility that sits there for 30 years generating money and making no demands on public services at all. No new education seats, no new police, no new water supply, nothing, no sewer. So solar facilities can be highly profitable if localities are allowed to apply their normal tax regime to these facilities. And I think they would be more receptive to them if they didn't feel like they were getting a raw deal. So that's the first thing I would do. And the second thing is the state government, many local governments, sort of the planning offices, you know, they're a little bit under-resourced. They have a lot of projects to work on. Somebody comes in and says, I want to use 4,000 acres for this one industrial facility. And usually people come in asking for 50 acres or 100 acres in the plan. And somebody comes in and says, I want to change the land use on 4,000 acres. It's just enough to make a local planning office choke. And so one of the things the state could do is be aggressive about providing decision support for localities, helping them understand the economics of it for their own economy, helping them understand what they might negotiate with solar developers. We'd like them to plant local pollinator friendly plants on their solar facility. We'd like them to shield it with these kind of plants, helping localities with the resources they need to respond to these new planned facilities, I think is another thing the state could do to sort of smooth the skids a little bit. Some localities are very receptive to new solar and have already begun to get the gains. And I think that other localities would probably do that as well. If they could get the revenues they feel like are appropriate for the facility. And second, if they could get help with the planning processes from, say, the Department of Mines, Minerals, and Energy and other state agencies, conservation and recreation and historic resources. There are a number of state agencies sort of involved in these processes.
Okay, great. Thanks. We're getting close to the end of the time we have. I don't see more questions from our audience. I want to jump in and ask you one more, though. I mean, how are you going to do all this without a serious price on carbon? What I mean is that I have read, I know you are an enthusiast for these cap and trade operations like the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, but I have read commentary that, in fact, the price of carbon in those things has been higher than the actual because of natural gas emissions went down and it didn't have much to do with the price of the carbon. That a fair? And so why don't you have a carbon tax?
That's right. So, first of all, if you look around at implementations of policies to reduce CO2 emissions, you'll find more cap and trade programs than taxes. And one of the reasons for that is I think it's really hard for policymakers to set a tax like this. First of all, what is an appropriate carbon tax? An appropriate carbon tax is more like $50 a ton. And, it, you know, this is an economist talking, right? We have our own ideas about what that appropriate tax should be. A price, I should say, not just tax. We can put the price on in a number of ways. So it is true that the cap and trade programs we have had lower prices than what we would have originally chosen. But let me just remind you, one of the first questions you asked me, are we taking account of early retirement of capital assets when we think about the costs? And what cap and trade programs have done so far is to start with a relatively high cap and then ramp it down once we discover the costs of actually achieving our reductions. And this is what's happened in the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative. They set a pretty high cap at first. When they found out that the cost was actually much lower than they thought it was going to be, they cut the cap in half. And then the next program review, they cut the cap again. So RGGI has responded to the information that markets have provided about the cost of reducing emissions by ramping the cap down, increasing their ambition. And this is something that a tax can't really do for you. And you, I don't think that there's any likelihood that we're going to get a $50 tax on CO2 emissions or a $100 tax, even more appropriate. But I think that if you announce in advance that you're starting a cap and you're going to ramp it down hard, and in Virginia's case, our current law is that our cap goes to zero in 2049, then everybody thinking about making an investment today has to think about what they're going to be paying for CO2 allowances in 2048. And it's going to be $350 or $400. Notwithstanding the price today, this is affecting investment decisions today based on what people know they're going to have to pay in the future. That's why you're seeing so many firms building up big banks right now, because they know the price is going to go up really high later on, and they want to get their emissions reduced now so they have some allowances to help them out then.
Thanks. That's a very good answer. Wonderful talk. We much appreciate your taking time out of your busy schedule to do this for us, Bill.
My pleasure.
We need to end it here, but I'm going to turn it over to my fellow board member, Peyton Williams, who will close the session. Peyton, are you there?
Yes, I am. Thank you very much, Bob. Professor, thank you very much for your presentation. I really enjoyed it. As one who's been following energy for quite a few years and with some experience in the nuclear area, having done my doctoral research at the ecology lab at the Savannah River site. So there was a certain amount of nuclear work in that. I am Peyton Williams. I'm a member of the board of directors for the Senior Statesman of Virginia. Thank you all for attending today. We are the board of the Senior Statesman of Virginia. Hope you enjoyed the presentation and will join the Senior Statesman of Virginia. The next meeting will be 8 December at 1:30 p.m., and it will be again by Zoom. This meeting will begin with the annual meeting, which includes the election of officers and new board members. As always, we'll be asking for topics of interest from the members for future presentations. The presentation immediately after the annual meeting is entitled Becoming an Age-Friendly Livable Community. The format will be a panel discussion on the eight elements that contribute to an age-friendly community and how the Charlottesville Area Alliance, also called the CAA, is advocating to ensure these are included in area comprehensive plans. Again, thank you for attending, and we hope you will join us in the future.